the Glasgow Neuro Society, in association with SNI, or Surgical Neurology International, and SNI Digital, are happy to present the abstracts and discussion of the 10th anniversary Glasgow Neuro Society meeting held in November of 2022 in Glasgow, Scotland. Hassan Ismail is president of the Glasgow Neuro Society at that time. He's from the Wolfson School of Medicine at the University of Glasgow in Scotland and the United Kingdom. Faculty commentators are Liketh Elakandi, who's the consultant neurosurgeon at the Queen Elizabeth University Hospital in Glasgow, and Amy Davidson, a neurologist, also at the University of Glasgow, also at the Institute of Infection, Immunity, and Inflammation in Glasgow, Scotland. Other Glasgow Neuro hosts were Elizabeth Middleton, Vice President of Glasgow Neuro, and Attica Chowdhury, another Vice President of Glasgow Neuro.
And on to our next panelist is Rishi Arisha, who's going to be talking about his work analyzing meningiomas in children, a rural Indian study. Over to you, Rishi.
Well, thank you so much, Hassan, and thank you so much for the committee for having me here. So my name is Rishi. I am a third-year medical student, and I study at the University of Manchester. And today I'd like to just present my work, which was done with the aim of analyzing meningiomas in children. And so the way I'm going to talk about this is that, first of all, I'm just going to give a brief introduction about meningiomas. And then afterwards, I'll talk about my work and possibly talk about some of the implications that it might have. So I'm just going to start off by talking about meningiomas. So for many of the viewers, this will be routine, and it will be especially so for the panel specialist doctors today. But I'm just going to go through it for the sake of someone who might not be very familiar with meningiomas. So meningiomas obviously are one of the most common type of primary CNS tumors. They mainly originate from the arachnoid cells that are present on the inner surface of the dura. There are many risk factors that can obviously increase the risk of developing these meningiomas, including things such as ionizing radiation to the skull. And there have been other risk factors that have been implicated as well, but obviously do require further research. Things such as differences in sex hormones, diabetes, arterial hypertension, and possibly even mobile phone usage have been implicated with meningiomas. Meningiomas by themselves are frequently asymptomatic, but sometimes they can have some symptoms, especially those that are related with a mass effect. So, for example, causing some sort of neurological symptoms, possibly some seizures and headaches. And I'm going to talk about that in my study as well. The way it's mainly diagnosed is with the help of an MRI, although PET scans could be quite useful in diagnosing meningiomas. They're, according to the World Health Organization classification, they're divided into three different grades, grades 1, 2, and 3, depending upon the characteristics. And the treatment is usually surgical. And so with that being said, I'm just going to talk a little bit about my work. So this work and the way I got involved with this actually is a bit special. So I actually reached out. I am of Indian ethnicity, so I do go back to India every now and then to visit my family that live there. And so I came into contact with one of the neurosurgeons, and it's quite an experienced neurosurgeon. He actually works in a hospital, and this is a government hospital. So the way healthcare works in India is you've got a private sector and you've got the government sector as well. And the private sector is quite well funded, and they tend to have they tend to be what people use more. But the public sector, the government sector, is where surgeons do work, and it works. It's based on a free for all model, so it's free at the point of care. So he is a surgeon who works in the public sector. So I got into touch with him, and I was actually fascinated to find out that meningiomas were being treated in this part of India, which is in the rural southwestern part of India. So then we got into contact, and we decided to sort of analyze the pediatric meningiomas. So just look at it's a bit like a case series. So like just looking retrospectively at the pediatric patients who came to the hospital, and then analyzing them. So I'm just going to go through my findings now. So pediatric meningiomas by themselves tend to be quite rare. And this was quite surprising that I was quite lucky that I was able to find some data on this, especially in India. So pediatric meningiomas tend to be quite rare. And there has been some work on it. There's been, especially coming from it's quite established in the Western world, really. But looking at the developing countries, there's really not much out there. So there was some work that was done in China a couple of years ago, in which they analyzed about 32 pediatric patients with meningiomas. And quite recently, there was a piece of work that came from Mumbai in India as well. But basically, what we sort of try to do is just analyze these patients and divide them and analyze sort of characteristics that we found in these patients. So I'm just going to go through them right now. So like I said, intracranial meningiomas in children are often considered to be rare. And these tumors are anywhere from, say, 0.4% to 4.6% of all brain tumors in children. And like I said, as compared to the thoroughly studied pattern of meningioma development in adults, pediatric meningiomas tend to show differing developmental patterns. So one study that was actually conducted in the University of Iowa in the US said that pediatric meningiomas tend to have more malignant histological subtypes, and they also tend to have greater rates of recurrence. So like I said, we just wanted to analyze the characteristics and see what they show, basically, and then just put out our research to the world so that it could potentially be useful. So I'm just going to talk about it now. So this was, like I said, a retrospective study, and this was an analysis of about 26 children presenting with meningiomas. And this was done, so the data over here was tracing all the way back into 1975 when they were first started to be recorded. So this was done in a rural government-run hospital in southwestern India. So just talking a little bit about the patient characteristics. So the patients that were mentioned in this pediatric cohort were from as young as children that were about a year old, to patients who were about 17 years of age. Now, meningiomas tend to mainly have a female predispondent, so they tend to be more prevalent in women as compared to men. However, in this cohort, that we found that it was quite surprising. It was slightly more prevalent in men as compared to women. So it was about 1.8:1. So slightly more common in men as compared to women. About 23% of these meningiomas happened in the posterior fossa, about 45% in the sphenoid, and about 21% in the tuberculum sellae, with the remaining developing in other regions for which the precise location on data and subtype was not available. Out of these 26 cases, about 4 patients actually tend to have atypical or malignant meningiomas. The hospital data said that the complete tumor excision was actually achieved in about 18% of patients, or whereas about there was mortality seen in about 3% of these patients. Now, one thing that this study tried to do was to try and follow up on these patients to see how they were doing. And as you can appreciate, in a country like India, where the population is massive, and with majority of these patients actually coming in from lower socioeconomic backgrounds, it was quite difficult to do that. So unfortunately, we were not able to follow up these patients. But we did find some information about one or two patients. I'm just going to mention that here, but it might not have much scientific benefit, but I'm just going to mention it. So we actually found out that one of our patients, who was about 13 years of age when he had the surgery, he actually had one of the anaplastic variant tumors, and he actually died because he developed a cerebral hernia. He actually refused, when he came back again, he actually refused surgical treatment, and he died because of a cerebral hernia. I'm just going to discuss, with all of that data being said, I'm just going to bring out a couple of, just going to discuss a few factors, a few points, to sort of compare between adult meningiomas and what this study could potentially indicate. Like I said, pediatric meningiomas tend to be relatively rare, and they're quite difficult to find. Like we said, in this study, it was more common in men as compared to women, but there is often a female predispondent. So that was something we was quite surprised to find. Obviously, the sample size in this case was very, very small, so we can't say it with certainty. We don't really know why this could have happened. Like we mentioned, sex hormones might be a potential risk for meningioma. So possibly sex hormones could play a role in pediatric meningiomas. So there was some interesting study that was done by Rushing et al. In the United States. And they basically mentioned that about 72% of pediatric meningiomas actually had a NF2 gene deletion, and they tend to be quite associated with neurofibromatosis as well, which was quite interesting to find. And obviously, we weren't able to analyze that in our study. So the symptoms that our patients mainly demonstrated were very nonspecific. Headache was actually the most common symptom, and epilepsy was a common symptom as well. And this is quite interesting, because, like I said, not much study has been done on this. So possibly this could sort of shed some light as to how meningiomas mainly present in children. And when these meningiomas, they develop, they can actually cause an increase in intracranial pressure. And they can cause, obviously, a local mass effect. And they can also cause some cranial nerve dysfunction, especially in nerves, in cranial nerves 2, 3, 4, 6, and 7 as well. So that's it from me. So we obviously had a lot of limitations in this study. The study was not... It didn't have a very large sample size. The data was very difficult to find, and we didn't have much guidance when it came to sort of coming up with this abstract and with this manuscript. But with all of that being said, I think what this could potentially help with is just add to that data pool, which is so limited to find, especially with regards to pediatric meningiomas coming from developing countries. So that's it from me. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much. You know, I think it's a big data compared to, because it's such rare tumors. So, yeah, well done for that. So, my first thing is, I know you've said most of the meningiomas we see in adults, which is much, much more common than the children, are de novo meningiomas. They happen without a rhyme or reason. Now, for kids, you correctly looked at primary causes. One of them is the NF2. You know, that's a family history. I know you can't, it's very unlikely you'll get gene testing done on these children, but family history is a good way of, you know, looking. Did you look into that, or was it just...
No, so we did not look into the family history. We were just trying to just mentioned in some of our discussions to look at some of the literature that's already been out there, and those points were mentioned. So we did not personally look into the family.
Yes. The other thing is radiation. So has any of these children been given radiation for things like tinea or, you know, ALL, things like that, you know?
Yeah. So this is something I forgot to mention. So none of these children were actually given radiation. Even with regards to the meningioma treatment after surgery, they were not given radiation or chemotherapy.
My final question is what proportion of them were grade twos and threes, whereas in adults you find, you know, almost 90% are grade ones and only about 10% are twos and threes.
So we weren't able to divide them based on histological classification. And this is a major limitation of our study. And this was mainly because we weren't able to find the accurate data, and we didn't want to give out any assumptions, but we weren't able to divide it based upon the Simpson grading, and to apologize for that, really.
Not Simpsons, I mean WHO. Anyway, so thanks, you know, but still a very good paper, because it's probably, you know, have you looked at the literature? Are there many papers which has got so many numbers of pediatric meningiomas?
So there have been some recent papers coming. And so, like I said, there was some work coming out from China in which they had about 40 children. There was some recent paper coming in and conducted in Mumbai, in which they had around 16 patients. But like I said, these patients were dating back all the way to 1975.
How many did you have?
We had about 26.
Yeah, that's a good number. Oh, anyway, well done. Pass it on to Dr. Davidson.
Thanks. Yeah, no, really great, really interesting. So, cards on the table. I obviously know very little about meningiomas. I tend to find them when I scan people for other things and then refer them to my surgical colleagues. So you mentioned about the NF2 stuff. So just out of interest, is that something that you screen for in all pediatric meningiomas, or is that something you think that we should be doing if that's a common factor, you know, even without a family history? Do you think we'd have a de novo hit rate that would be worthwhile thinking about something like that?
That's a very good question. So it could be possibly something that we could look into. Obviously, this was coming from a setting in which resources were limited. And obviously, given in that sort of setting, it will be very difficult to screen for neurofibromatosis. And it could be, but coming onto the NHS, coming onto the UK, and coming onto the developed part of the world, this obviously, the fact that it's related to NF2 wasn't something that we found out from our study, but it was something that was mentioned in a study, a very interesting study conducted at the University of Iowa. So with that being said, where in those sort of settings in which the resources are available, I think that's a very, very, very interesting proposition to possibly look into the relationship between NF2 and meningiomas. And possibly that could be a way in which NF2s could be possibly screened for. But like I mentioned, this wasn't something that came from our study, and I do apologize. My knowledge on this is very limited.
Don't need to apologise. You've done really great work, especially in what I imagine would have been challenging circumstances to collect the data. So, and as you say, you've added knowledge to
to the literature we didn't
have much knowledge about before. Like, it can only be a good thing. Never be sorry. Mm-hmm. It's good.
I guess actually I've got a question about the practicalities of collecting such data. Obviously, given you mentioned it was in a public hospital, the data records went back to 1975. What was this is just from a pure research point of view, what were the practicalities of trying to collect data like this from your point of view?
So it was actually quite challenging. So just to give some insights, to tracing up to maybe 10 years back, the data was actually shifted onto a sort of an EPR setting that you notice in the NHS. So there were digitalized records available. But before that, most of these records were handwritten, and they were stored in thick piles of books. And they were divided, because of which it was slightly easier for us. But this was data that was just collected and stored away, in a bookshelf and possibly, to be forgotten. But, it was quite good that we were able to get something out of it, at least, I believe.
Well done.
Lovely. And actually, do you reckon, given the, again, just talking about the practicalities, given that difficulty, do you reckon from a research point of view, any might have potentially been missed given that difficulty of trying to find these paper records?
Yeah, that could also be a limitation, not only to our study, but especially to, like I said, coming from resource limited settings. And
absolutely.
And especially looking years and years back, like going almost 50 years back in time, where data obviously is very difficult to get to come from. Many of these hospitals would not have even recorded the surgeries carried out, and especially coming from back in those days, it was very difficult to even validate the credentials of the surgeons actually performing these surgeries, especially in those kind of settings. So I would imagine that it's very difficult to find data regarding this, but to the best of our ability is what we could find and we put out there, really.
Absolutely. No, thank you. And a really interesting discussion. And that wraps up this panel discussion recording.
We hope you enjoy these presentations. The information provided in this program is for informational purposes and is not intended for use as diagnosis or treatment of a health problem or as a substitute for consulting a licensed medical profession. Please fill out your evaluation of this video to attain CME credit. This recorded session is available free on snidigital.org. Send your questions or comments to ausman@snidigital.org. This program has been supported by the James I. and Carolyn R. Ausman Educational Foundation, owner of SNI and SNI Digital, and the Waymaster Corporation, producers of the Leading Gen television series, Silent Majority Speaks and Role Models, and the new Medical News Network. Thank you.